Well, as Emily mentioned in the welcome, we're starting a new series today, and we're going to be talking about a concept or an idea that is so central to what we do every week here at New Denver Church. Day in and day out, it's so central to a part of our lives as followers of Jesus. And it's a concept that's really familiar to us, but I think that's part of the danger of anything that is familiar can sometimes become unfamiliar because we begin to take it for granted. So over the coming weeks, we're going to talk about the idea of worship. What is worship? What does that word mean? And more specifically, what does it mean for us as followers of Jesus? What does it mean when we think about this idea of worship? And what are the different ways that we express it? And I'm excited about this series because we've set it up so that you guys are going to get to hear from a lot of different voices and a lot of different perspectives. People who lead us in the practice of worship every week. Alyssa's going to play a part, and Emily's going to play a part, and Adam, and Brian, and so many different voices. But as we get started today, I want to just kick us off by laying a foundation with just exploring this concept of worship. And where did it come from? How did we get to where we are today? And what is it that we think about when we think about worship? And maybe how is it different from ways that worship is practiced and experienced in other places around the world? I always think it's helpful when we're talking about something to start with definitions, because words are really important. And it's the only way that we convey ideas or meanings or feelings. But at the same time, words only have the meaning that we pour into them. So when I say a particular word, something's going to automatically come to your mind, but that may not be, we may not be talking about the same thing. So when I talk about the word worship, I came up with this definition by combining a few things together. But I think when we think about worship in general, worship is reverence or adoration offered to something or someone of supreme value, worth, or power, such as a divine being or a supernatural power. So I think worship is this kind of reverence or adoration that is given to something that is ultimate, something that is bigger than us, that's beyond us. That's what leads us to worship. And there's a lot of different ways. We're going to talk about the different ways that we can express worship. But that, I think, in general, at a baseline, is what worship is. So where did that come from? Well, today I want to go all the way back to the beginning of ancient civilization and work our way forward to where we are today. And to do that, we're going to have to think back a little bit, back to our high school world history classes. So, yeah, history teacher in the front. That's cool. I didn't plant that, but that's awesome. So, I know world history is a little further back for some of us than others, but if you think back to that period in ancient history known as the Bronze Age. So this is a period in time when human history and civilization really begins to flourish. If you go back and you think about, you remember the concept that, or the region of the world that was known as the Fertile Crescent. It was the area now known as the Middle East where civilizations really began to thrive. And somewhere around this time, about 4,000 plus years ago, we start to see that people living close together, they begin to start banding together in tribes and civilizations, and they start to develop, they start interacting with one another. Technology begins to grow. They call it the Bronze Age because people began to learn to work with metals. The first written forms of language start to emerge. This is why we know things about that period of history that we don't about times before that, because people started writing down their experiences in ancient languages and ways to express themselves and to share their experiences for those who would come after them. But as these civilizations advanced and as people began to grow and they experienced life and tried to understand the world around them, they began to realize that there were forces at work in their world that they didn't understand. They began to realize that there were forces that had a direct impact on their life that they didn't know about or understand or couldn't control. So as people began to settle in one place, they began to cultivate crops and grow crops, and they began to grow herds of cattle and sheep and domesticate animals. And so as they began to do that, they began to realize really quickly that there were these forces, that the crops depended on rain and they depended on sun, and they needed enough rain. If they didn't get enough rain, the crops wouldn't grow very well and they wouldn't have enough food to eat. But they didn't need too much rain, because if too much rain came, then they would wash away. And they figured out that they needed sun. If they didn't get enough sun, then the crops would not grow very much, wouldn't produce very much food. But if they got too much sun, they would wither and they would die. And even for these people, as they looked around the world and tried to figure out how things worked, their own bodies were a mystery to them. People would get sick develop diseases and suddenly just die, and no one would know how or why or what was going on. They figured out how babies got made. They somehow figured that out. That was instinctual. But even that seemed like a mysterious process because some people were not able to have kids. They would try their whole life and never be able to have kids. And sometimes those kids would be born and they would live and they would be healthy. And other times they would die. And no one really understood why. And then someone, we don't really know where it came from, but it began to emerge simultaneously within all of these cultures and civilizations that were developing that time. Someone had the idea that there are unseen, personal, spiritual forces, gods, deities, supernatural beings that controlled these unseen forces. And they began to develop this conception that man was created by these beings to do work for them, that these gods, these deities were lazy and they created man to be able to do things for them. And so they began to develop this conception that man's responsibility was to give things back to the gods. And what we see is around this time, as all of these different mythologies and stories about different gods and different ways of practicing begin to develop, they're all very different. But in general, they have a lot of similarities. People believe that there were these supernatural beings that had control over these unseen forces in the world. And they felt like their responsibility, that the practices that began to develop was that people felt like it was their responsibility to bring things and give them to these forces, these gods, in order to appease them and get what they wanted. And so the first practices, religious practices of worship, began to emerge during that time. And it's very consistent. One of the things that's consistent across all of the different kinds of religions that developed, and everyone, this was very tribal and territorial. So each different tribe or people group developed their own sort of thinking about who these gods were. And they began to get tied to geography. So the Egyptians and the Babylonians, the Assyrians, they all had their own sets of gods. And we see this come into play in military conquests, where they believe that if you beat somebody in a war, I mean, your god was stronger than their god. And there were these similarities in practices that they began to develop. And one of them was this idea that they had to bring these offerings to appease the gods to get what they wanted. So people would build these altars. They would build tables, either out of wood or out of stone. It would be like a wood table or a block of stone. And they would bring these things, and they would leave them on the table as an offering to the gods. And they came to the altar to give the gods the things that were precious to them, their food. Sometimes they would sacrifice animals. And they would leave them there in exchange for the favor of the gods. So if they wanted to have a successful harvest, maybe they would bring some of their corn or some of their crops and they would leave them there, a portion. Or if they wanted their herds to flourish, they would slaughter a calf and leave it there. And this is an artist's representation of an Egyptian woman and what it looked like potentially for her to be kneeling before this altar. And they would create these representations known as idols, where they would offer these things in hopes that the gods would give them favor. Now, of course, the problem with this kind of barter system that developed, you know, hey, I'm going to give you something, gods, and in exchange for that, I'm going to get something that I want in return. The problem with this kind of system is not that it didn't work. The problem from their perspective is that it was inconsistent. Because you see, sometimes they would come and they would offer an offering to the rain god, and it would rain. Praise be to the rain god. But other times, they would come and they would make an offering and nothing would happen. It still wouldn't rain. Because they didn't understand the forces that were going on, the meteorological forces that we now, thinking from a modern cosmology, think about and know govern the weather patterns. They were thinking that there's something wrong. There's something wrong with this offering that I've brought. Is there something wrong with me? Is there something that I did wrong? Did I do something to offend the gods? Or maybe it's not enough. Maybe I need to bring more. Maybe I just need to bring more and give more because that will appease them. And this is the thing about this kind of religion, this kind of worshiping false forces or this kind of false worship, because it always leads people to give more and more of what's most precious to them, which is why it's understandable how at some point or another people had the idea of killing another human being, even their own children, to be able to appease these gods or forces. Because if you're going to give what's most precious to you, eventually that's going to lead you to the things and the people that are closest to you. Now, this idea of bringing crops or produce and or killing an animal and putting it on an altar, it sounds strange to our 21st century ears. As we listen to this in America, it sounds crazy. Like this is something from the ancient past. But I was having dinner with Rachel and Jesse this week, and we were talking about some of these spiritual forces that they just referred to. There are still people in Uganda, educated people, who believe that ancestors, their spirits of their ancestors, still govern a lot of their daily experience and daily life. And they still regularly will perform these kinds of sacrifices. They were telling me about, they found out a woman who was kidnapped and murdered in a ritual sacrifice because this really well-known musician wanted to ensure his career would continue to be successful. And he's offering, making this offering to these unseen spiritual forces. There's still lots of people who think that this is the way that you interact with these unseen spiritual forces or gods. I was looking for this picture online. Never, ever Google animal sacrifices. Like, don't ever Google. Let me just save you from my pain. This is not ancient history. This is many religions around the world still believe in this kind of worship by I give something, an offering, and I get something in return. Kind of a barter system of worship. And at the same time, let's be honest. How many of us have not engaged in some form of this in really, really difficult times in our life? How many people have been in a place where they said, God, I don't know if you're there, I don't know who you are, but if you could just get me out of this mess, if you could just please make her like me, or please don't let her be pregnant, or please, God, let this business deal go through. If you just do that, then I promise I will insert whatever it is that you're offering to God. As much as things have changed since the dawn of human civilization, there's still something in us that's drawn to this exchange system of worship with these unseen spiritual forces that we know that are outside of our control, but we think have impact on our life. So in the midst of all this, in the midst of the Bronze Age, in the midst of this culture, this broader culture of worship by exchange and multiple gods that developed across many, many different cultures, somewhere around the 20th century BC, around 4,000 years ago, a man named Abraham was born. And Abraham, the biblical book of Genesis tells us that Abraham was born and lived with his father and his family in what is now modern day Turkey. And so as we learn about Abraham, what we find out is we're told that Abraham had an encounter with God, capital G, God, Yahweh, the creator of the universe, the one true and living God speaks to Abraham in the midst of this culture of polytheism and worship by exchange. And he makes Abraham a promise. He tells Abraham, he says, I want you to leave your people. I want you to leave the place where you live. I want you to leave the people that you live among. Leave your father's household. And I want you to go to the place that I'm going to show you. And I'm going to make you great, Abraham. I'm going to make your family great. Eventually, you're going to become a nation. And through that group of people, all of the world is going to be blessed. Now, leaving his home, leaving his family probably meant that, and leaving his father's household probably meant he was leaving his father's gods and his people's gods. There's a pretty good chance Abraham practiced this kind of worship of the spiritual forces that were seen around him. And God, the God of the universe, Yahweh, tells him to go to the place that he's going to show him. And he makes him this promise, no strings attached, no offerings required. He simply says, there's no need to offer produce or killing animals. I'm making you a promise. If you trust me and follow me, follow after me, I'm going to make you great. I'm going to make your family great. I'm going to bless the whole world through you, Abraham. And Abraham took God at his word. And he trusted him. And he followed. He believed that God would do what he said he would do. And even though Abraham and his wife Sarah were very old, they had for years tried to have children and had been unable. And so it seemed like a joke that they would ever have a family of their own, much less that that family would grow to become a nation. But they believed that God was true. This God that was intervening into their life was true to his word. And eventually, God was true to his word. God allowed Abraham and Sarah to have a child, and they named him Isaac. And God led Abraham and his family to this land that he promised, which was inhabited by many, many tribes and groups of people. And he said, one day this is going to be yours. Your family is going to own this land. And along the way, we're told through the story that each place on the journey that Abraham stopped, he built an altar. He built an altar out of stones or by stacking them up like this picture or taking a stone slab, and he would make offerings. Now, what's interesting about this is that God never tells him to do that. He never specifically says, go build an altar to me. It just seems that Abraham continues worshiping, expressing his worship the same way he had always known, the way that everybody did in the culture around him. And it seems that God uses that. It seems that God knew how Abraham would express worship and meets him in that. In fact, Emily's going to come back in a few weeks and talk about a very significant turning point in Abraham's life that took place at an altar, but I'm not going to get into that today. As Abraham's continued to, his family continued to grow, eventually Abraham died, and eventually the people that came from his family actually became the nation of Israel. It became the people that God promised. And it took them over 400 years. They went into slavery to Egypt. And finally, through descendants of Abraham, Moses, and Joshua, they finally came back as a nation to this land, to inhabit the land that God had promised them. And as they entered into this land, God gives them a law. God's still speaking, still working through his people, still shaping them into the people that he wants them to be. And this time, he gives them the law, the Ten Commandments, and a very specific set of instructions about how and where and when they're supposed to worship him. And the first commandment that God gives is don't have any other gods but me, because all of that is false. If you're bowing before a statue or worshiping the rain god or the sun god, it's just not true. Because God knew that there would always be this temptation because everyone else surrounding them was still worshiping in this exchange system. They were still buying into this false reality that if somehow or another they gave enough of what was most precious to them, that they could persuade these unseen spiritual forces. And God's telling Abraham, he says, I want it to be different for you. I want everyone else to know that your God is the one true God. And this law is going to help you to do that. Now, what's interesting is you may be thinking, if you know the story of the Bible, you know that sacrifices were a part of this system. So you may be wondering, why in the world did God use something that was so disorienting? Why would God use something that other religions, false religions, would use? I don't know. The Bible doesn't explain God's reasoning. But once again, I'm just left to wonder, maybe God just met them in what was an already accepted cultural practice of the day, but God restricts it, and he gives very specific instructions about how and when. He doesn't leave them guessing and wondering if they've ever done enough, if they've given enough, if they've done enough, if they've done it right. God gives very specific instructions because God wants them to know that following him is the way to real life, to real, abundant, flourishing human life. Because God knows that when you come to worship, it is a transformational experience. And God knew that if they were drawn away to these false gods that everyone else, every other nation around them was worshiping, then it wasn't neutral. It wasn't like that was just a neutral practice. Eventually, that was going to lead them down a deceptive and destructive path. Because giving away what's most precious for you, hoping to sway spiritual forces that are out there, all that really produces is the anxiety of wondering, have I done enough? Am I good enough? And God never wanted his people to live in that way. He wanted them to be marked. He wanted all the other surrounding nations to know that there was a God in Israel who was different. He wanted them to know that worship of the one true and living God changed them, to be the kind of people who reflected his character. So coming to the altar, when they would come to worship, and you can read through all of the specific instructions in the Old Testament and Leviticus, but when they would come to the altar, they came and they made these sacrifices, and they were remembering what God had done for them in the past. They remembered the promises that God had made to Abraham. They were remembering all the miraculous things that God did through Moses to bring them out of Egypt. They were looking back and they were remembering. But as they killed these animals, and they made these offerings that were a part of the sacrificial system of the law, they were also remembering that they failed every single day to live up to the expectations that were there in the law. Because the problem is that the law is perfect. It reflects God's character and his nature. And the problem Israel had through history, as you read through the Old Testament, is they're never able to live up to it. So they continually offer these sacrifices as a reminder that they were falling short and a reminder that God was continuing to grant them forgiveness. As they came to the altar, they came to remember, but they also came to receive God's forgiveness and his protection. It was a reminder to them that God was continuing to care for them and watch over them. And the law was perfect in the sense that it reflected who God was, but it was imperfect because it was a standard that no one could ever live up to. And there's a reason for that, because the law was simply a shadow of things to come, a pointer to a greater reality which was yet to be realized. In the book of Hebrews in the New Testament, the author explains that Jesus was the ultimate fulfillment of the law. That is, he came in flesh to live in such a way that showed us what God's character looked like. He was God walking around in skin and bones. What he said, what he did is what God would do and say with people when he was here, because that's who Jesus was. And in his death and his resurrection, God did something that the sacrificial system could never do. It reconciled human beings to God in a way that bulls and goats never could. Listen to the way that the author of Hebrews puts it. This is from chapter 10 of Hebrews. It says, "The law is only a shadow of the good things that are coming, not the realities themselves. For this reason, it can never, by the same sacrifices repeated endlessly year after year, make perfect those who draw near to worship. Otherwise, would they not have stopped being offered? For the worshipers would have been cleansed once and for all and would no longer have felt guilty for their sins. But those sacrifices are an annual reminder of sins. It is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins." And the author's reminding us here that the law was given as a way for people to worship, to come and to worship God, to express their adoration to the one true and living God, not by giving something to get something in return, but they went to the altar to receive from God his forgiveness and to be reminded of God's faithfulness in the past. And the author goes on in the book of Hebrews to elaborate that Jesus, in coming and living a perfect life, showing us what God is like, and then being willing to die on a cross, somehow did something for us that this sacrificial system never, ever could. What Jesus did on the cross accomplished forgiveness once and for all people. And here's what's so amazing. False religion, false worship, is always based on this idea that you can do something to earn the favor of these unseen spiritual forces or God. It's about giving something to get something else in return. But the worship of the one true and living God is about coming to the altar to receive forgiveness and love and acceptance, something that we could never earn, so that we can stand up and walk away from the altar and go give that to a world that is hurting and broken and in need of those things. Yes, worship of the one true God is different than any other false god that has ever existed. There is no exchange system in worship of God. When we worship Yahweh, the one true living God, creator of all the universe, what is it that we have to offer or give him that he needs? This is the God who created everything that is, the cosmos, the universes, everything we look up into the stars and see our bodies, every form of life on this planet. If he knit us together in our mother's womb, cell by cell, what in the world do we have that we could offer him that would sway him to make him do what we want him to do? It's not that kind of relationship. Worship of the one true living God is about coming to the altar to receive his love and forgiveness. What we could never earn, we could never deserve, but that he offers us freely so that we can receive it, stand up from the altar, and turn around to go give that to the world. Now, if you're here today and you're not a religious person, you're not sure what you believe about God or Jesus, I may have totally weirded you out with this whole message today. And I get that. It's a little weird to think about the idea that there are transcendent realities or supernatural beings or forces that somehow we interact with on a regular basis. After all, hasn't modern science answered all those questions about where rain comes from and where how the sun operates? And don't we know all that stuff? Well, it's true. It has, and we have a very different cosmology than ancient human beings. But at the same time, isn't there something in us that still wants to know more, that still comes to the edge of our knowledge and realizes as much as we come to know about the world and the universe that we live in, there's so much more that we don't understand and don't know, and that there are forces that bring order and structure and purpose and meaning. And what are those? And who, if there is a God, who is that? And what is he like? And can we know him? We all wrestle with those kinds of questions, and we go looking for answers in lots of different places. Because, see, I think we were made to worship. We were made to give our reverence and adoration to something that is ultimate. And if we don't give it to God, we're going to give it to something else. See, we don't have altars where we go kneel down in front of with false idols that we offer produce or kill animals for. But we most certainly, worship is alive and well for us. Every week, people pay large sums of money and spend inordinate amounts of time and enter into these crazy rituals and paint themselves and dress themselves up, and they go to these huge cathedrals. We call them stadiums. And they bow down, they chant, they scream, they give their heart and their soul, and they walk away with a feeling of elation or dejection. You want to know what true religion, what true worship looks like? Should be at Mile High Stadium on a Sunday for a Broncos game. That's worship. We spend massive amounts of money on outdoor gear and bicycles and lift tickets and yoga classes, and we pour our time into recreation in exchange for the thrill of feeling alive, maybe pushing back the effects of age, the steady decline of our youth and our vitality. We worship the creation around us, and we feel connected to Mother Earth and all that's around us. And we miss the Creator while worshiping the creation. And most noticeably, maybe these days, wherever we go, we walk around bowed down to the God of technology. Literally bent over, staring at a screen, ignoring the people and the world around us, as we feel the thrill and exhilaration of being connected to a world of information and people that are out there somewhere. Now, just to be clear, there's nothing wrong with any of these things. They are all good things. They are created things, things that we as human beings can and should enjoy. The problem is when we take good things and we make them ultimate things, that's when they become idols. And idols will always disappoint. Because anything that is not truly ultimate, anything other than God that we give our adoration to, will always, always disappoint us eventually. There may be a thrill, there may be a sense of exhilaration, there's always a huge payoff at first. The problem is not that false gods don't work, it's that they don't work consistently. The same is still true for us. So the question is not, are we worshipers? We're all worshipers. The question is, what are we worshiping? And if we're worshiping anything other than the one true and living God, then we're chasing after something that's false. And that's not neutral. That has an impact on our life. That is eventually destructive. That does eventually lead us to a place of destruction. But when we come to God, the one true living God, exalting him above all other things, enjoying everything that comes to us as a gift, as an experience of what it means to be human in a created world where he's given us good things to enjoy, when we're able to enjoy all things as under him and him as ultimate, then we go into our everyday lives differently. When we come to the altar to worship God and we receive his love, we receive his acceptance, we don't need to go out and make more money or buy more things or feel that sense of identity through any of the false gods of the world that give us those, that offer to give us those things. When we come to his altar and receive that from him, we walk away changed, because altars alter us. They change us. And the question is not, are we worshipers? The question is, who or what are we worshiping? As we end our service today, I couldn't think of a better way, a better thing to do, better expression of what this looks like than to celebrate communion together. On the night before Jesus went to the cross, he had a meal with his followers, and he knew what was coming. He knew he was going to give his life to settle this debt, to forgive once and for all, to eliminate the sacrificial system, to eliminate once and for all this debt that we had, to reconcile all of humankind who would come to him and ask for that forgiveness, to reconcile us to God. And at the meal that night, he picked up the bread and he broke it. And he said, "This is my body broken for you. And in the future, when you gather together, take this and eat it and remember me." And likewise, he poured the wine that night. And as he poured it, he said, "This is my blood, the blood of a new covenant, a new agreement, a new way of people interacting and worshiping God. And we take this in the future. Remember my blood spilled for you for the forgiveness of sins. Do this in remembrance of me." So today, as the band plays, they're going to come up now. And they're going to play in just a moment. We have tables set up on either side, and we have the elements, the bread and the wine, set on a table. It's a folding table, but it's still an altar. And I invite you, whenever you're ready, to come, break off a piece of the bread, dip it in the juice, take it, and remember Jesus. Remember the sacrifice he made for us. Remember that you're coming to a table not to give, regardless of what's gone on in your life, what you've done right or what you've done wrong. You can come to this table and receive what God offers freely to all of us. His love, his forgiveness, reconciliation. But we also come and we remember that that forgiveness came at a price. And that none of us are perfect. That each one of us in our own way has chosen to stray away from God, chosen to go our own way. And so before we come to the table, join with me now as we read this prayer of confession together.